we need a squad to take a correspondent out to take some pictures. And what he went for was to take pictures of Guamanians that the Japs had cut their heads off.
Wow.
There was about 30 of them. I saw about 15 of them. I guess the Japs had them as prisoners, and they escaped, and they caught them, and in fact, whacked their heads off. So. But that was quite a gruesome sight.
I'm Jeff Wells, and you're listening to Walk Among Heroes, a podcast dedicated to honoring the brave men and women who allow us to enjoy the greatest privilege in the world, freedom. Each Tuesday, I'll sit down with an incredible military hero. We will listen to unedited, authentic stories in their own voices, in their own words. We will hear incredible military stories from some of the greatest heroes to ever walk the face of this earth. And who knows, we may even learn a few of their secret life lessons along the way. Although none of us can begin to imagine what they've seen, heard, and experienced during our time together, I'll do my very best to take us all for a walk among heroes. Here we go. I'm Jeff Wells, and you're listening to Walk Among Heroes podcast episode 28A with Mr. Paul Frederick, United States Marine Corps 3rd Division. Mr. Frederick lives just up the road in Lexington, Kentucky. Born and raised in Kentucky, he's just an amazing man. He was part of 3rd Division, as I mentioned, in the Marine Corps, and he fought in Iwo Jima. And I learned of Mr. Frederick by reading about him in the newspaper. Has really cool story more recently here in the last year or so. There's a very famous country music writer from Nashville by the name of Jim Collins, who wrote songs like The Big Green Tractor and, you know, other big hits. And he learned of Mr. Frederick's story, which he'll explain in the podcast how that all came to be through a family connection. But anyway, Jim Collins, the country music writer, called Mr. Frederick, and they had a long conversation, and Mr. Frederick told him about his service, and then he wrote him a song, which is a pretty cool thing. But Mr. Frederick was right in the thick of it in Iwo Jima. He lost many of his friends. He sacrificed just a tremendous amount, as you've heard from other guests on this podcast that were involved in that horrific battle for more than 30 days on that rock in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. So just want to thank Mr. Frederick for coming on and sharing his story. There's going to be two parts to this episode. Part A will consist of Mr. Frederick's childhood, growing up, training for the Marine Corps, and then it'll take us right up. You said that you were born and raised in Kentucky, right?
Right, yes. Actually, my whole family, my great-grandfather came out of Pennsylvania.
Okay.
And they was all farmers. I think my father's generation was the only one that actually went into, working outside the farm.
Ah, I see.
But, well, back them days, about the only thing you do was delivery truck drivers or deliver milk or something like that, you know. I mean, I was born in, my grandfather and them had a farm right out of Lexington, what's called Spears, is down close to Kentucky River. But my mother and father lived in Lexington, but they went down there for me to be born. I don't know what was the cause of the doctor came out of the next field or what the deal was. But all my married life, all my life period has been in Lexington except the time I was in the military. So.
Understood.
I'm what you call a Lexingtonian, I guess.
Well, it's a good place to be. That's certainly beautiful. Yeah. It's certainly beautiful. And when you were growing up, I mean, what was it like? I mean, obviously the Great Depression was happening, and you know, I don't think that our youth.
I don't think, Jeff, that the Depression hurt Lexington as much as it did other parts of the country. I mean, not just Lexington itself, but see, most of the people here, well, they had people lived on the farm as far as being short on food, because they would, people would bring in food and stuff like that, you know, or go fish. And now my father, he was always delivery trucking, and then he chauffeured for a millionaire here in town in the late '30s. Yeah, late '30s. But she drove to Michigan in the summertime and Florida in the wintertime, and naturally he would have to go, and he figured that was just too long to be away from home.
Sure.
Now, see, he had four sons by that time, and so he quit that, and I don't know just exactly what he did there for. Anyway, but he finally ended up buying a service station, just not the building itself. We didn't have the money to build it, but he just kind of bought the stuff inside it, and that was in, I think, must have been, I was trying to think of days, either in the spring of 41, I think it was the spring of 41, and that was just kind of catty corner from where we lived. So it was right there, you know, just, so I kind of worked for him. Well, my job was to help him. My job was to open up the station at 6 o'clock in the morning. So, and then I'd go to school and then come back and work, you know, in the afternoon. But he was the one that always closed up. And then, see, then just before we got into war with war starting in December 41. And I knew they was going to get me.
Yeah.
Sooner or later. So I just dropped out of school. I just said, well, you know, since going to school, so I worked during the station, and then there was a printing company, printing office next door, and they needed a delivery fella. See, I got my driver's license, and I was 17. I was just 17 years old, but I worked for them, and I opened up a station. I'd go there right next door. I'd go work, deliver stuff, you know, my 8 hours, and then I'd work a little bit that day, go eat supper. Yeah, I did that. In fact, I had two jobs.
what age did you drop out of school? How old were you when you dropped out of school?
17.
Okay. Wow. And then
that's when I met my wife, through a friend of mine. I bought an old car. Well, the first car was an old Chevrolet I get $30 for. and then I stopped one night and headlight lens all fell out. So I got rid of that thing. I was going to rewire it and everything, but couldn't find out I couldn't. So I ended up buying an old Ford 50. No, it was a 35, a 36, a $50. And that's how come me actually to meet my wife, in a way, roughly. Although I told you not to. My best buddy was going with this gal, and he said she's got a sister. And I said, well, maybe I'll meet her or something. Anyway, well, we did. And he said, I don't know. I said, I'd like to have a date with her. He said, I don't wish to go with you because she's engaged to a boy. That we got caught in that thing before World War II. You know, you're going to be gone just a year. Well, they had more than a year. Well, I met her. She didn't.
Okay, so you dropped out of school. You're now in, our country's at war. Obviously, Pearl Harbor had happened, so our country's at war. And you're knowing, at some point, you know, your Uncle Sam's going to come calling. So at what point did you enter the
Navy? I think it was the first part of July. See, I was 18, the 5th of July.
Okay.
And right after that, I went down to the recruiting station and enlisted, but I didn't have a birth certificate. I don't know whether they think I was 18 or not. I don't know what the deal was anyway, but I had to go get this lady that was with my mother when I was born and take it down there and all a bunch of heavy notarized and everything. But they took me anyway. And I was inducted July the 30th of 42.
Okay.
In Louisville. And then they sent me to Parris Island. And I tell you what, Jeff, the first time I heard a roll call, I said, I must be in the Foreign Legion. I never hear so many Skakuskis, Skowskis, and all that. Because there was several came out of New York and New Jersey with names I'd never even heard of before. I said, what in the world is going on here?
So you make a very good point, and I never thought about this, but during the Depression, when you were growing up, places like Kentucky that are very fertile, farmland, you know, agriculture type areas had to be much better off than other parts of the country, you know, Texas and other places like that that couldn't grow, because you could grow your own food and you could raise your own livestock and so on and so forth. I never thought of it that way, but that makes perfect sense.
Well, another thing too, see, there was no factories. I just want to say one of the first factories that kind of come in Lexington, that was though. 50s when IBM come in here, and up to that time it was either people worked on the racehorse. People hired a lot of people.
Right.
I mean, a lot of people. And then, well, there's the old saying, one half lived off the other half, and
makes sense.
It was either.
So you were. So you entered the military in 1942, went to Parris Island, and is becoming a Marine, is that something that you always wanted to do? Did you have a...
Yeah, I guess, you know, when I had all these posters out, you know, and everything, that's what I wanted. So I didn't try anything else at that time. I just, you know, they turned me down. I'm probably went in the Army or the Navy, but they took me in.
And so how was boot camp?
I tell you what, Jeff, we had actually, in a way, we had a short boot camp. It just lasted 7 weeks.
Oh, interesting.
Generally, they last longer. We had 3 weeks of close order drill.
Interesting.
3 weeks on the rifle range, then a week back to camp on bayoneting and stuff like that, and then they shipped us out.
Interesting.
And because they shipped us, they scared us after boot camp. Some went one way, another one. But several of us went up to what we came to June now, but back then it was New River, North Carolina.
Okay.
So they kind of rushed us through boot camp, which I'm glad they did. I'm glad I did. But we made it through all those guys. They had it scheduled pretty tight, though. If you were sick, went sick bay one day and missed, you had to drop out and go to another platoon. So I don't know what their schedule was, but they kept us busy. I mean, there was no lollygagging around. It was do what the DI said or else.
And the drill instructors were nice guys, right? They were really nice to you.
Well, yeah. You know what we think about? You know, they were just doing their job. I mean,
sure.
That's what they was being paid to do, and they was training us, and just, well, I say yes sir and no. That's one thing I did not have to learn to do, learn to say yes sir and no sir. But my father was strict on that in the service station. When somebody got gasoline or anything, he was thank you and yes ma'am and no ma'am, and you know, as far as that's concerned.
He taught you right growing up, so it was much easier to make that transition.
That's right. That's right.
That's, and so you went to, you said you went to North Carolina after you graduated basic.
Yeah.
Okay.
We went to there was I forget just how many we had in the platoon. I don't know. Anyway, well, we ended up going up to North Carolina. There was about 12 of us that kind of stayed together.
Okay.
And they at that time, see, that would have been the first part of October. They was starting with 50 caliber machine guns, anti tank, and anti aircraft.
I see.
It was air cooled. I mean, they weren't no war. And they just started that. So they made two squads of us in that. And our sergeant that was going to be our sergeant, he was in school. In fact, he was on his way back from Pearl Harbor when the war started.
Wow.
He'd done a tour over there and was back home, but he was in school. So they kind of, we had kind of an old gunnery sergeant that kind of took us under his wing. He had about 20 years in Marines at that time. And I'll tell you a little answer. You might get a thrill out of this. He had us out one day at what they called them round robins. We were studying first aid.
Okay.
And we saw this Jeep come bouncing across the field. Gunny got up, and Lieutenant... name was Rushmore. Well, one or the other. Anyway, he said, "Gunny, Captain wants to see you." And Gunny looked at his watch. "Tell him I'll see him at the chow." That lieutenant's face turned about four different colors of red. But they didn't understand that the scene when the war started, that wasn't about a little over 20,000 Marines.
Yeah,
and most of them had already served together or knew one another. I mean, rank and file and everything knew one another. And but well, that Rushmore got killed on Eagle anyway. Mm-hmm. Anyway, but I'll just never forget that when the gunny got up and slewed him, and he said, "Captain wants to see you." The gunny said, "Well, tell him I'll see him after chow." Yeah. So we got that machine gun had three parts. It had a tripod and a receiver. And after they gave me the receiver,
okay,
and a barrel. And we trained with them and carried that thing all around. And then we went to, then they give us, they got big hearted and gave us a 5-day leave. You go from North Carolina to get to Lexington on a Greyhound bus, so you ain't going to have a whole lot of time at home.
Sure.
I think I ended up being home two nights. And that's when I had a date with Myrtle then. So, but anyway.
Was that your...
We're back.
Was that... you? So you met before that and you were dating?
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
okay.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Got it.
Okay. And then I went back to North Carolina. They shipped us out to California to Camp Elliott, shut out of San Diego. I don't know. I've often wondered whatever happened to that camp, because I know it's probably all built up now and residents and everything, but I don't, I just never did hear no more of it. We weren't there too awful long, though. But we trained there. And then I think they got the idea that they could run us around down New Zealand just as well as they could in California.
Mm-hmm.
So we, in February 14th, I think I'd been 43, we boarded ship the USS Laurel Line. It was converted. It was a luxury liner, but they converted. We had, I think somebody said it had 5,000 troops on it. I mean, there was Marines and Merchant Marines, and I think there's some Navy nurses on there. There's just a little bit of everybody.
Wow.
And old green me, you know, I said, boss, I told someone, we got together, we said, boy, we leave here, we'll see all kinds of ships, convoy and everything. We left San Diego, we didn't see a ship till we got to New Zealand. but they said they could outrun a submarine. I mean, a Japanese submarine. Thing would do 20-some knots, I think. So anyway, it's a funny feeling.
So you were completely by yourself, because you always hear about these large convoys and so on and so forth, and you got out there and looked around and there was nobody. Wow.
Nobody. So we landed, see, I think we was aboard, she takes about 2 weeks to get down there. And then we went out to a camp right outside of Auckland, New Zealand. It was a abandoned New Zealand army camp, and that's where we camped. But most of the New Zealanders soldiers was over North Africa fighting.
Right.
And Japan was moving down New Guinea, and they thought that they was going to, you know, maybe invade Australia, and they figured we was close enough there that if they did, they could get us up there a whole lot quicker than they could from California. So
makes sense. And at what point were you assigned to your unit? Was it after you arrived there in New Zealand, or were you assigned before you left? Or?
I was assigned after we got our boot camp, went up to North Carolina. That's when they assigned us, you know, to what we was going to do.
Gotcha. So you knew going over there what unit you were in and all that kind of stuff.
They put me in at that time. They put me. It was M Company, 3rd Battalion, 21st Marine, 3rd Marine Division. They were just forming a 3rd Marine Division. But most of the guys, most of our officers and non-coms had been to Iceland and been stationed up there, and they brought them down there to train us.
So you were assigned to 3rd Division. You went over and they sent you over to New Zealand. And then did you train at that point while you were over there? Or what was the day-to-day?
Oh, yeah, we trained. We was always training. They had us doing something. We've done a lot of hiking in New Zealand. I get to go on 3-day hikes. Then we got Liberty at Washington. Well, not too often. No, we go into Auckland, New Zealand on Liberty. And then we left New Zealand. I think it was, I'd say June or and went to Guadalcanal. Now, the fighting at Guadalcanal was over.
Yeah.
But Japan was still bombing. They'd send, I think I was told, the month before we went was the last time the Jets had made a pretty good bombing raid on Guadalcanal. But actually, we got there, Washington King Charlie, we called him, could come over and drop bombers. They took bombing on the airfield. We were stationed in a big coconut grove.
What were the conditions like on Guadalcanal?
It was hot, and we done the same thing in our training, just like we did in New Zealand. We'd go on hikes and carry those things and those receivers and tripods and whatever, so that the machine gun. But it wasn't too bad duty. I mean, in a way, we knew we had to do it, so when you know you got to do something, you might want to make up your mind to do it. That'd be it.
Amen to that. That's absolutely well said. So, how long were you in Guadalcanal? I assume that Guam
We left New Zealand, and we was going to hit our. Our battalion was in reserve for Bougainville.
Right.
3rd Division hit Bougainville. But they hit the 1st of November, and then we was going up in reserves, and that's when that ship I was on got torpedoed. Now, it was an APD. That stands for Assault Personnel Destroyer.
Okay.
They were World War One destroyers that they had converted into troop ships that would carry about 200 men, just channel hopping, you know, I'm not carrying very far.
Sure.
And in that convoy, I think we had about 7 or 8 of them plus a bunch of LSTs and other ships. But actually, we was to be in reserves, and then our ship got hit. So,
and so was that a daytime situation when you got hit, or how did that talk me through how that incident happened? That sounds horrible.
Well, being this fellow was in the ship, was in his boat sleeping. And I saw these flares, and I told him, it's just like what the first part of that song. We come down and met these 4 guys, and I told him, I think I'm going to be sure what time it is. I got as far as the clock. I didn't get as far as the water fell. And that's when the ship was hit, and I caught on fire. And they got killed, and I jumped in the water to keep an oof. Well, the water puts out fire, so that's it. And, then you talk about a strange feeling, though. You do that, and then when you come up, you don't hear nothing or see nothing. And you just got to figure, what in the world am I at? What am I going to do? But then I heard some guys talking, and I got with them, and that's when the Talbert sent out, Hayes boat and picked us up.
So did that torpedo take the ship down in its entirety?
Yeah, it went down in 20 minutes.
Wow. Wow.
I can see it at a distance.
And
in the ship's log, I got, here's one thing up, it said 0352. That's 3 o'clock in the morning, you know that.
Sure.
Several members of the troop detachment abandoned ship without orders. Every person that jumped earlier was drugged into burning oil slicked by the forward motion of the ship. The greater part of the troops that were lost were burnt to death in the oil slick. Now see, that's another time the guardian angel was me. I wasn't caught nothing slick.
Wow.
So, and then, as I say, it came out later, somebody said in a paper that they weren't going to pick up survivors anymore as long as the convoy was under attack. In other words, we've been out there another 4 or 5 hours. I mean, we got there about an hour and a half before they picked us up. But then we went aboard, the Talbert. It got under attack. And they dropped the troops, they took me back to Guadalcanal.
Gotcha.
And I was in the hospital in Guadalcanal, one called the hospital. And then they flew me down to New Hebrides. See, the nurses weren't that far up north, up the Nalas. Because they wouldn't let the nurses, I think, come within 200 miles of the lines. Those islands that we'd taken.
Right.
And so I was down there, and I spent Christmas, Thanksgiving, probably in Guadalcanal in the hospital. Went down to New Hebrides hospital down there.
What were they treating in the hospital? Where did you get
them? My arms, hand, my right side mostly was my arms and my hand. And my right ear.
Mm.
And that's what they treated me for. In fact, you can't tell it now, but I mean, one of the doctors down there, one of the talked back to me in New Zealand to get my ear drafted. I said, I don't want to do it. Jeff, I didn't want to leave my outfit. So I got to knowing these guys, and I knew if I went down there, they'd put me on another replacement outfit with a whole bunch of guys I did not know.
Right.
So I was ready to go back to Park Canal. So I went back up there, and in the meantime, they had done a lot of changing. They'd done away with using the 50 caliber machine guns. Training guys with bazookas and the flamethrowers.
Hmm.
And they said something about giving me a flamethrower, and I said, not PFC telling somebody what to do. I don't go over. I said, I don't want no flamethrower. So they gave me a bazooka. So I trained with a bazooka, and I had an assistant. And then we left there.
How did those bazookas work or operate? Were they pretty easy to operate, or were they difficult to operate? I've never met anybody.
Well, that was when, once they got that, had even yours, they folded up. This didn't fold up. It was just like a stove pipe. And then I had what they call an assistant, what you had to have,
Sure.
I shot it, and he the one that loaded it. I don't remember shooting the thing over 3 or 4 times if I shot that much.
Yeah.
He'd been training.
Yeah.
And, as I say, then, we boarded ship then to go to Guam. And, we went up to Anna Wheaton and boarded a LST to go to Guam. In fact, I pulled a must mess duty board. I spent 6 weeks on that LST. Pulled a must mess duty on it. Because they hit Saipan, and they run into a lot more trouble than they figured on, and they thought they might have to use us in reserve up there. But we eventually landed on Guam. Every night we'd be headed towards Guam, and the next morning we'd be headed back to one of the other islands.
Well, they wanted they, as you said, it took a lot longer in Saipan, and they wanted to wait until at least a certain percentage of the island was in our hands, right, before you guys landed.
Yeah. Jeff's one afternoon sent out 3 planes for us. And we had we called it, the only thing we could see, we had a destroyer as an escort, but the main fleet was just out of sight, which I wasn't too far. Well, we heard the general quarters went, and these 3 planes come out, and this destroyer plane, it went through our convoy we had. It got in a battle with one of the dive bombers, I guess. I don't know whether they shot the plane down or not, but the one that came over our ship and dropped a bomb or a torpedo, hit on the bow of the LCI, I think he killed 7 or 8 guys on it.
Oh, wow. They
threw the bow off of it. That night, and then the next morning, they scuttled it and sunk it.
Wow.
And then we landed on July the 21st. Yeah, July 21st.
And how were the conditions there when you landed?
Well, see, I was in the fourth wave.
Gotcha.
And we landed on the alligator tractors. That's what I come up to LST with. And they told me and my assistant, our job when we hit the beach was had the bottom full of clover leaves, bombs.
Yep.
And I told the guys that was on the way, I said, now, you guys jump off this thing. I said, get out of the way, because we're going to throw these things, don't tell them where, and then we're going to leave. So we did, and we just being, we just kind of tagged along with the infantry, you know. I mean, it was all infantry units that down to it. So,
right.
But they never did call on us to for our bazooka, so without glass. So.
Well, that's a good thing. Yeah. That's a blessing.
I finally got rid of that thing. But I tell you one thing, Jeff. One of the things that sticks with me pretty good is they told us one day that we need a squad to take a correspondent out to take some pictures. So we went along with him. And what he went for was to take pictures of Wyomingians that the Japs had cut their heads off.
Wow.
There was about 30 of them. I saw about 15 of them. I guess the Japs had them as prisoners. And they escaped and they caught them. And they whacked their heads off. So. But that was quite a gruesome sight.
The Japanese, and you know, you were there, you know it firsthand, but from everything I've read, the Japanese were just brutal. They would mutilate, you know.
Yeah.
Just absolutely
brutal. There was one of the fellows, they said that correspondent had that thing come back to the States, and it was in a paper showing it.
Interesting. But,
That was a cruel bunch of people, I mean, at that time. And MacArthur, I give him a lot of credit for after we beat, he didn't think too much of Marines. Anyway, I think he done a great job when we occupied Japan and put him in charge. I think he done a super job.
Well, you're one of the few Marines that I've ever spoken to that actually praise MacArthur.
Yeah.
There's a lot of Marines that don't like MacArthur.
Oh, yeah. Well, it was that military thing, you know.
Right.
Between the services.
I know. It's all rivalry.
We went on and we took Guam. And then we had a camp set up at the up on the north end of the island, actually where they built the airfield. In fact, they was up there surveying while we was camped there. We'd go take patrols and go over what I call Tulagi Beach, see if there's any stray Japs, you know, running around over there. And they was up there surveying for the airport. And then they built up a camp down closer to the Pagania. So dude down there, but then after I got rid of the bazooka, and I got transferred in back to L Company as a BA Arman, and I had the assistant BA Arman that was kissing carrots, some more ammunition. Well, then by the time we got ready to go to Evo, they decided they were going to keep him back in rear echelon. So I didn't have no assistance. So I had just so we went up the Evo after we, you know, took Guam, and we was going up there as reserves for the 4th and 5th divisions, and we laid off, and then they decided, well, they run in the morning. They thought they was going to run in, so D plus one. They loaded the 21st Regiment, which was, I was in, and we rode around in Higgins' boat all day. And we never did land. They said there was too much clutter on the beach, and it was rough. So they took us back aboard ship, and then we went, when we landed the next day, we rode around for quite a while. Then I said, we're going to do this same thing over again, but we did land then. And they didn't know just exactly where they was going to put us. Mm-hmm. And in between the fourth and fifth divisions. And but one of the first things I picked me and another fellow out to be a stretcher bearer. Told us to go across and pick up a guy been shot in the leg. In fact, only in his leg. Now you might want to scratch this off your record. Yeah. He'd been shot through his pecker. Oh.
And that concludes episode 28A, which is part one of our two-part interview series with Mr. Paul Frederick, United States Marine Corps, current resident of Lexington, Kentucky. Just an amazing man and a true honor to meet him and talk to him about his amazing story. And, you know, the one thing that strikes me about Mr. Frederick, obviously his relationship with his wife for many, many years, Myrtle, which he talks about over and over again. And you just see in talking to all of these incredible heroes, you hear about their rock solid relationships throughout their lives back home with their significant others. And this is no exception, listening to Mr. Frederick talk about Myrtle and the life that they had together. And that was actually featured in the song that Jim Collins had written. And then just secondly, if you go back and you listen to all of our guests that we've had so far that have been involved in Iwo Jima, including Woody Williams himself, who was awarded the Medal of Honor for his actions on Iwo Jima. If you go back and you listen to their stories, many of them had significant periods of time where they just can't remember. They blacked out. They can't remember. It all blended together. And I know that was a long time ago. It's 77 or 78 years ago at this point. But so many of them had these time periods where they just simply can't remember because the battle was so horrific. And day in, day out, day or night, there was no getting away from the battle because the island was so small. It was well within artillery range from both sides. And then the Japanese would usually attack at night, which meant that nobody could sleep, and it was just a disaster of a situation. So it's very, very common when talking to those guys to hear them talk about how they just simply can't remember certain periods of time. And you'll see in part two, that's also the case with Mr. Frederick. I want to thank everybody for listening. Thank you so much for following our podcast. I've had the opportunity to talk to some amazing folks who have emailed me and written and corresponded online. So thank you for that. If you'd like to send us a message, please feel free. Email us walkamongheroes@gmail.com. If you'd like to follow us online, you go to our website, www.walkamongheroes.org. If you'd like to check us out on Facebook, facebook.com/walkamongheroes, Instagram, @walkamongheroes, and you can find us on YouTube and other places. Very, very thankful for your support. We're thankful for all who have checked into Wish for Our Heroes, which is a nonprofit, all-volunteer organization that we support that helps military families with basic needs. If you'd like to check them out, you can catch them at www.wishforourheroes.org. Thank you so much to all those who stand guard protecting our way of life, our police, our firefighters, all of those here stateside, and then, of course, our military stationed around the world who sacrificed so much for all of us to give us all what we call the greatest privilege in the world, freedom. I want to thank those in the Army, Navy, Air Force, Marine Corps, Coast Guard, Space Force, and everybody else standing guard around the world. Thank you so much for listening. Thanks for sharing Mr. Frederick's story, and we'll see you in 2 weeks.